Welcome to episode 690 with my guest, Dana Killian. Let me start with my name, Paul Gilmartin. This is the Mental Illness Happy Hour, and it's a place for honesty about all the battles in our heads. I'm not a therapist, and it is not meant to be a substitute for professional mental counseling. I think that voice right there should tell you two things. One, I'm not a therapist, and two, I do need a therapist. Thank you, those of you that are supporting the podcast on Patreon. We still have a long way to go, but man, do I appreciate those of you that are stepping up. And I know there's all kinds of things that I wanted to share with you, and as soon as I hit record, they all disappear from my brain. So let's read some surveys, see what happens there. This is from the Comment on Someone's Survey podcast filled out by our friend who calls herself the Habsburg Jaw. And she writes, on an earlier episode, there was a survey with a story, quote, honey for sale, unquote. It's stuck in my mind since you read it, and I was wondering if you could read it again or share which episode it was in, as I've struggled to find it. I'm so sorry, but I did a search and I cannot find it. So maybe if there's a listener listening right now who knows where that survey is, let me know. You can shoot me an email through the website. And you can also fill out a survey. But you got to get to those through the website. So you're going to be the website anyway. So you figure it out. This is from the Voice in Your Head survey filled out by Jabberjaws. And what are some of the things you tell yourself about yourself? He writes, you are useless. You've wasted your potential, lost all your friendships, and destroyed the only loving relationship you've ever had. You've wasted your life, and you don't deserve to live. No, buddy. Sending you some love, man. And that's such a common voice. It's such a common voice. It just loves to focus on the mistakes. You know, I'm gonna talk to you. In the voice of my favorite therapist, who also happens to be a power forward and Canadian major juniors. He plays for the Guelph Storm. And he would say, Jabsy, take it one shift at a time. Be hard on the puck. Life's a tilt, brother. Love yourself. When you go out there for warm-ups, take off your bucket. Show off that flow. You got two options in life. You could go five hole or top cheese. Doesn't matter which one you choose as long as your mitts are saucy. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by Anne. And by the way, that little bit of humor attempted right there probably got the response that Dana gave me for my attempts at humor during our interview. I don't think she found me to be amusing, but I enjoyed our interview. It was very informative. I can't judge somebody for not finding my jokes funny. I have no idea if my jokes are funny. All I can do is try. The rest is up to you. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey filled out by Anne. And she writes, this is more of a general question, speaking of humor, about Representative Richard Martin. What happened to the video on him? I love that character, and I hope you bring him back. It's a character I started doing a satire of the far right, and kind of Christian hypocrisy and, you know, materialism, and as well as the you know, politics in America. But I started doing this character in 04 and have done them on and off since then. And there's some video floating around, but I'll put a link in the show notes to a video that I think still holds up. It's from 10 years ago, 11 years ago. But a lot of the jokes still hold up there. I think there's two in there that are a little dated, but it'll give you a good sense of my sense of humor if you're not already turned off by it. This is from the Back in Time survey filled out by a woman who calls herself Cherry Poop. Actually, we've got this survey from her, and then the next survey is from her as well. And share a moment in your life where you wish you could go back in time and say something to yourself. She writes, I would go back to when I was 20 and about to give birth. I would tell myself all the regrets I have from when my daughter was little, so I could be a better mom. I would explain child development and talk about having patience and understanding. I would tell me to stay away from certain people and just be present for my daughter. I would also tell myself about job options available that I had no idea about. Young adult me had no support and was dealing with severe childhood trauma. I wasn't in any way equipped to take care of a baby, no guidance at all. I would be my own support if I could go back and talk to me. I just hope I would listen and take it in. That, first of all, thank you for that. And yeah, that's an interesting question is, would we listen to ourselves? Because if that advice was coming from our parents, we'd be like, yeah, whatever, old person. Share a positive moment from your day. And she writes, right now I'm laying in bed with my cat. I can hear her chattering at me for pets. She closes her eyes as I pet the soft fur between her ears. I love that little weirdo and feel glad that she's with me. Thank you for that. And then this is her survey from the What Has Helped You survey. What are your issues/struggles? I'm lost and have no clue what to do with myself. I don't think I ever knew, though. I hate my body. Pregnancy and aging has ruined me. Feelings of not being good enough to have friends, but then not wanting to deal with potential friends. Maybe I'm just an asshole. What's helped you deal with them? Becoming numb after feelings of immense sadness. What, if anything, have people said or done that's helped you? People can tell me I'm thin and beautiful, that my body still looks good and I look young, that I'm a caring person. I'm none of that. What they say just makes me angry and sad. To which I would say, who are we to tell somebody that they are wrong for feeling positive things towards us? You know, one of the most important things I think that we can do is let somebody love on you. Don't counter it with, yeah, but I'm this and I'm that, and if you only knew this and you only... No. Just let them fucking love on you. It reminds me of a story. It's, I think, apropos. I was at dinner with a big group of people. I was doing some... It was some show busy thing, and I didn't know 90% of the people at the table. And this woman said to me, I love that jacket you have on. And I was like, yeah, I got it on the sale rack at REI. It was $40. I mean, I don't really like the color. And she said, when somebody compliments what you're wearing, just say, thank you, I got it in Paris. And I laughed. And I was like, yeah, duly noted. Let somebody like something about me and don't tell them that they're wrong. As you guys know, the internet isn't... is an important series of tubes and wires. And I occasionally come across facts from the internet that I think are really historically important. And I thought I should share some of those with you. And this is one that I came across. The Pony Express got its name because mail was delivered by girls on ponies they got for their birthdays. The first one was a girl named Mabel who rode Mr. Hoofy. Because she rode all day and all night, she missed a lot of school and was illiterate. But Mr. Hoofy attended night school and got his PhD in education and taught her to read. But they had a falling out and she never got beyond children's books. However, she became a famous rodeo clown. Clowned? But she couldn't handle success and died of alcoholism. But Mr. Hoofy had also earned a medical license and, as the town doctor, was morally obligated to treat her and managed to revive her from the dead and revive their relationship. He became famous for being the first horse to bring a rodeo employee back from the dead. But he couldn't handle fame and died of alcoholism. He was buried in an unmarked grave because she still couldn't spell. We are going to take a quick break and see if we have any sponsors. This episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. Just imagine that you're at the vet and you get a bill, or they say, well, to do this operation on your dog, it's going to cost such and such, and you love your dog or your cat, and you don't have the money to pay it, and you have to make that very, very difficult decision. Well, the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. One more time, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/mental. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance. This episode is sponsored by Cerebral. Cerebral is here to help you achieve your mental wellness goals with professional therapy and medication management support. 100% online, you'll experience the all-new Cerebral Way, an innovative approach to mental wellness designed around you. You'll get a personalized treatment plan from a therapist, prescriber, or both in a safe and judgment-free space. And judgment-free is definitely how I would describe the sessions that I've had with my Cerebral therapist. Her name is Megan. She is thoughtful. She is empathetic, and she's knowledgeable, and she's been helping me clarify baby steps I can take to help achieve the professional goals that I am trying to set. I'm a big fan. All Cerebral clinicians are vetted, credentialed, and trained to help you feel better. They stay up to date on the latest studies and breakthroughs so they can provide quality care that's based on rigorous research. To get started on your path towards better mental health, Cerebral is giving our listeners 15% off the first month of online therapy, medication, or both. Get started at Cerebral.com/podcast and use the code MENTAL. That's Cerebral, Cerebral.com/podcast, and then use the code MENTAL to get 15% off your first month. Make 2024 your best year yet. Offer only valid on monthly plans. Other exclusions may apply. See site for details. And then finally, this is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey, and this is filled out by Miami Vice. And he simply writes about his alcoholism and drug addiction, a temporary friend, but a long-term foe.
That feeling of being trapped in your own life with no way out. All my alters have different handwriting, different affects.
I'm somebody in prison.
My mom taught me about rape.
And I'm nobody on the streets.
Before she taught me about love.
Nobody will ever love me enough.
There's two lies.
A kind pimp.
Yes.
The secret, shameful life at home.
Happiness isn't the goal.
That you always just don't talk about. And then there's the front.
The goal is meaning.
It's hard to go into the dark places.
I should have leaned into that feeling and gotten curious about it.
Recognize when your fears are driving your behaviors.
What you resist gets louder.
And run toward them.
She said, you first. And I said, I might be gay. I was with a girl. And I said, and what do you have to tell me? She said, I'm moving to Florida and this is my last session.
I am here with Dana Killian. And we're going to talk about living with an addict, alcoholic, and I think we're going to talk about a lot of other things. We were chatting before we started recording, and by the way, I'm dog sitting Carlin, my friend Brooke's dog, so things might get a little nutty in here. Thank you for making the slog from Tucson / San Francisco. You were up north for a book fair, and you've got a book out called Where the Shadows Dance. He Got Sober, I Got Broken. Where do we start? You know, let's start with maybe with the marriage, and then the things that the topic of dealing with an addict brought up about your upbringing, issues, etc.
Sure. So I was married for 25 years to a very high-functioning alcoholic, and I didn't know that one could exist without the obvious signs of alcohol addiction. Mm-hmm. It was foreign to me. I was expecting the slurring, the stumbling, the obnoxious behavior. But my husband didn't display any of that. He passed out. He left bottles in strange places. So it was
hid bottles?
Yeah.
Okay.
Empty bottles under the seat of the car, on top of kitchen cabinets. And those were the first signs that there was a problem.
How far into your marriage / relationship?
We were probably about 3 years into the marriage when I began to think that these bottles in strange places just didn't make any logical sense to me. I mean, who stashes a bottle on top of a kitchen cabinet? That's a hiding behavior.
Sure.
But he wasn't displaying any of these other qualities of what I perceived as addictive behavior. We began to have conversations about the drinking, you know, what's going on, and he would explain it away rationally. You know, yeah, you're right, just a little stressed at work. Nothing that appeared to be out of the ordinary. And his drinking would moderate when I brought these conversations up. But the drinking always came back. And the more we went through those early stage, back and forth, what is going on? Obviously, as the loved one of an addict, you become more and more concerned. Over time, the conversations get a little more pointed.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened for us, and I think with a lot of addictive behavior, is that that's when secrets and lying and secret hidden behavior starts coming in. And I went into a place where there were no obvious signs of drinking, yet I could smell booze on him in the middle of the night. Those kinds of hidden behaviors. I didn't fully internalize that he was addicted until we got to a place where I realized he was drinking straight out of the bottle. That was the obvious. This isn't anything we can explain away just by heavy drinking. This is problem behavior. Nobody does that.
What do you remember thinking or feeling when that fact came on your radar? Did you witness it, or was it something that you kind of put together, two and two together, and realized he was...
I had to put two and two together.
Yeah, together.
Yeah, I was in a position where I was not witnessing him drinking straight from the bottle, but I was seeing signs that drinking was occurring without me witnessing it. like I said, I'd wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and smell the booze mm-hmm. when I didn't see any booze being drunk.
And when you had gone to bed or seen him before you headed to bed, there were no signs.
There
he didn't
no
smell
signs.
Like booze. Yeah.
He had switched to vodka at that point, mm-hmm. specifically for the ability to hide it, to eliminate the pressure. Obviously, there's no limit to how many beer bottles you can hide.
Beer
vodka,
very
on the other hand.
Yes, beer very inconvenient to hide. Hey, get in here. We're sharing with Donna. I didn't pronounce that right, did I?
Dana,
God damn it. I was sharing with Dana before we started recording that I've been sober 19 years, and the type of alcoholic you described is the alcoholic that runs in my family, my mm-hmm. father and myself. And I didn't even know my dad was an alcoholic until my mom told me when I was heading to college. Yeah. And I'd never seen him slur his words. He had vodka around the house. I never knew that. And when you talked about the drinking at night, that was my favorite time, was after my wife went to bed. And I remember vividly going for another beer because she would be asleep. And I remember crushing the cans as quietly as possible so I could pack as many into the garbage bag without it looking obvious.
Yeah.
So it's sorry to make it all about me at that point, but I guess I just want to emphasize how common the unobvious drinker is out there. We don't lose the job, the house. We may lose the wife eventually. But it's a tough one.
It is a tough one. And we do need to talk about it, because this is something many of us are not aware of, that alcoholism can present this way. And in our situation as well, he was doing great at his job. The world did not know.
Was he drinking during the day?
No.
Yeah.
Very controlled about his drinking. He was drinking when I was putting the children to bed. That's when the vodka bottle was opened.
Wow.
And other times as well, eventually. But
gotcha. Yeah, because it's progressive.
It is progressive. And addiction is progressive. There is no question.
And along the way, you know, you said he kind of paid lip service, but would blame it on stress or whatever. Did you ever reach a point where he said, yes, I know I have a problem, I'm going to get help?
That didn't happen until I forced it.
Talk about that.
There are no straight lines in addiction.
No.
this is one of those things when you are the loved one, you don't know. And we tend to think that I just need one big conversation, because that is so scary to have in
yes.
the first place.
If I can present the facts, he'll understand. Yeah. You have no idea that you are dealing with a spiritual, emotional, mental something right. and not a logical thing.
Correct. I think about that, and I talk about that a lot. I'm a logical person. I was applying logic to a disease that has none.
Yeah.
And that both helped and hurt us.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
how did it help?
Help from the standpoint of there can be a benefit that the drinking was hidden. My children, they didn't see it. It was around them, mm-hmm. but it was so subtle. It was so out of their line of sight.
Was he withdrawn with them, or would he be present?
He was present.
Yeah.
But he had a high-powered job, the late nights, the compartmentalization of when he drank. It really wasn't in front of the children. So like your experience, we didn't tell the children until he was working on sobriety.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden your entire family is in shock because nobody saw it but me. You had to be living with him. And by living with him, I mean sleeping in bed with him.
Yeah.
Because that was really the only way to tell.
What was it like being the only person that knew? How lonely did that feel?
It It is, but in the middle of all that, you're not thinking about yourself. You are thinking about how booze controls your life. This is a man I love. How do I keep him alive? How do I get him sober? What is the bad thing that is going to happen? Is he going to wrap himself around a tree? Will my kids be in the car when he does it? What are the awful things that are going to happen? And you are in this place of, I certainly was, and a lot of the people that I talked to were, of silence. It's marital loyalty. It is protecting your family. It is being so busy keeping everybody else together and your life together, because the addict is not, can't be relied on consistently. They are not predictable. So we take it upon ourselves, rightly or wrongly, to keep life together, and we're simply too busy to think about what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Our job becomes, how do I get this man that I love sober? What am I not saying? How am I not saying it right? What help do I need from other people? I need to go talk to a therapist. I need to read a book. Somehow we put it on ourselves, mm-hmm. as we are the ones, because we have the most to lose, that are responsible for getting this person to understand and accept sobriety. And in most cases, it just goes on and on and on until one of you just can't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. And so what changed?
There, like all addictive situations, there had been episodes, including a DUI, including me forcing him into therapy as condition of continued marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And those things seemed to help for a while. But it underestimates the pull of the addiction. And it underestimated, I guess, the commitment that he had to truly internalizing, this is who I am. There was always this, I can control this if I want to. Because he could do it for periods of time. He could go for months without a drink. 6 months.
And did that give you the illusion of control over him?
I don't know if it was control over him.
Perhaps influence?
Influence, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if the person you love isn't influencing you to get sober, if the threadbare state of your marriage isn't controlling you, isn't influencing you, mm-hmm. to get sober, what's it going to be?
Right.
And then as the loved one, you're in that place of, what do I do now? Nothing else is working. But, and we all think of, what is our breaking point? When do we leave? But if I leave, what happens to him? Will I then be responsible for his death?
And all of these things, for the uninitiated listening, are the common myths that the loved one tells themselves.
Correct.
With no idea that they are part of a disease, of a familial system. We have no idea that our addiction to the alcoholic and their drinking and our obsession with them is its own disease that needs as much intensive work. When did that dawn on you? Well, I'm assuming it dawned on you.
Not till much, much later. I didn't view myself as having a problem other than I love this man. I want him safe. I want my good life back. What do I need to do to help him get there?
What would you, if you could get in a time machine and go back and talk to yourself at any point in your marriage to him, what might you have said to yourself or given yourself?
That is such a hard one to answer. During that stage, I was certainly seeking out therapy, sort of. But the therapy I sought out was, okay, I'm married to an alcoholic. How do I speak to him differently? I wanted new words.
So it was still all about him?
It was still all about him, because that's what I saw as our problem. Get the booze out of our life, we go back to our wonderful marriage. Because I thought everything else about our marriage was wonderful. I did eventually seek out outside support group to try to help me deal with my own mental state as I was working through, I love this man. He has a problem. I know he's trying. But I'm kind of messed up now.
When you sought this group out, were you aware yet that it was going to be more about what's going on inside you than how you can control or influence him?
I don't think I walked in the door with that understanding.
Yeah.
And that was part of the reason that I struggled with the group in the beginning.
Yeah.
The messages, when you are the loved ones of these kinds of groups, seem to be focused on two big categories of stuff, which are stop enabling him and some version of you have to let go. You can't solve his problem. You didn't cause his problem. You can't fix him. I didn't see how I was enabling this man. Aside from still being in his life, I couldn't wrap my hands around. I wasn't calling in to work for him. I wasn't making excuses for him. I wasn't buying him booze so that he would drink at home. I didn't see my behavior as enabling. Beyond, I'm still here in his life. I haven't walked yet.
What were the enabling behaviors as you look back now? Just being in the marriage?
That's the only one. I've given it a tremendous amount of thought. And continuing to be there is probably the only thing that I can identify. Maybe I'm still too close to it. I don't know. But that's all I've really been able to sort through.
You know, one of the things that I've learned is consequences are a really important part of not enabling. And obviously each situation is different. But one of the worst ways we can enable someone is threatening consequences and not following through on them. And when you're dealing with an untreated addict, alcoholic, who will lie and manipulate, not because that's who they are at their core of a person, but because they're unwell. And the only thing, the only tool they have is to numb themselves at that point.
Yeah. There certainly were consequences that I dished out. There were moments when he was asked to leave the house. But it never lasted long because what I wanted was proof that he was making an effort. And when the consequences were dished out, he did what he said he was going to do. It just never lasted. It wasn't a permanent solution. And my consequences, I don't think we go to, all right, I'm done, as our first consequence. These are things that accelerate. Okay, he's out of the house for a week. Okay, get into therapy or I'm done. You know, okay, so he does that. The drinking continues. It's out of the house. I don't want to see you anymore. And we'd go for weeks not speaking.
Living together.
Living apart.
That sounds sexy.
No, we had a final, I'm done. You can have me or you can have vodka. And it was only then, and he was asked to leave the home, and he left for 3 weeks. But I was still left with, what do I do? We spoke, and that's when he went into a rehab center. Finally, there is not a one-stop shopping.
No.
Do the one thing and it's done. It is a journey, and it is a process for the loved one, and it is a process for the addict. The other choice is simply to end the relationship and say what? Talk to me if you ever get sober. And, you know, some of us actually get there, but we're forced to face how far do we go for our love of ourselves, and our love of this other person.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it never occurs to us when we're enabling that we are abandoning ourselves.
It doesn't. It doesn't. Our focus for so, it, part of it is because it's gone on for so long. Mm-hmm. It's like that frog in the pot that is slowly boiling.
Yeah.
We don't know it's happening to us until something happens in our life and we can gain distance and therefore we can gain a little bit of perspective.
So he starts attending, he goes to rehab.
He went to an inpatient rehab. He had been in therapy. The therapy had been somewhat helpful. It got him to at least the place of admitting, I'm a person with a problem. Right. I am an alcoholic. It didn't completely stop the drinking. It abated it.
No, it would be really rare, in my opinion, for someone to get sober from just therapy.
I don't have the experience in it than you, but in our situation, he never would have gotten sober without concentrated inpatient rehab center.
Yeah. So he began to change in terms of getting sober. Talk about you as he got sober. The real show begins.
That's exactly it. We had been married for 20 years at that point, dealing with this for a very long time. And in my naivete, I assumed that the rehab center, that too would be the answer. He actually did get sober. He didn't go willingly, even though he agreed. He didn't go convinced he couldn't manage this on his own. But he got to the rehab center and he saw his future. He saw the jaundice. He saw people in wheelchairs. He saw other successful men who also had problems. That was very important for him as a high-functioning man who really cared about his job.
And I imagine cared about his family.
Yes, it, absolutely.
I think it's so agonizing for the person wrapped up in the addiction to see themselves moving away from everything they love, but unable or feeling like they are unable to stop it.
I would imagine that when you've been drinking for decades, there's a lot of rewiring that's going on in your brain. You're using lots of behaviors that allow you to not see your reality, to blunt the pain of who you are, the hole inside you. So you may be sober, but that doesn't mean you're healed.
No, that's the beginning.
Yeah, and yeah. I think that's another thing that we don't talk about enough. It's that next stage of who am I now?
Right.
As the loved one, who am I now as the addict? We're re-looking at behaviors and life completely in a new way without the filters, with trying to rebuild everything.
Dealing with feelings.
Dealing with feelings. Dealing with someone else's feelings.
Right. Let's focus on you, though, as this new chapter of your life, your marriage began, where you weren't obsessed with his drinking, or maybe you still were, even though he was sober.
Well, unfortunately, there's a twist in the story at the rehab center stage. Because while he was at rehab, I found out that he had been leading a secret life. Throughout our marriage, there had been other women, an unknown number of women. He doesn't know how many women. So that's where the he got sober, I got broken came in. Because I had thought, get to the place of no more booze and we've got something to work from.
How did you find out?
Ask the right question in the right way at the right time when he was vulnerable.
And talk about what you experienced physically, emotionally, mentally in that moment when you found that out. What do you remember feeling in your body?
That's about all I can tell. it was a moment of trauma just removing the world around me. And a feeling of just sinking into the floor. I found this out during family week at the rehab center. And I don't remember leaving the center. I remember driving from the center to the hotel I was staying at and just my hands gripped on the wheel of the car, trying to keep the road in front of me because I was afraid I was going to pass out. I remember being in my hotel room, not knowing what to do with myself. I don't remember how I got back to Chicago. I don't remember a whole lot of the year that followed after
that. Wow. And were the kids at the family group when this?
No.
Okay. No, that's good. And how old were your kids when he went to rehab?
They were in college at that point.
Okay.
So it's a very murky time. It was a devastating time. And that was also followed up by my mother dying and my cat dying.
Oh.
Those were the additional highlights of that horrible, horrible year of my life. I was so traumatized that I couldn't even muster enough energy to immediately run to a divorce attorney. It was that bad. I was curled up on the floor.
I can't imagine the false sense that everything's better now, and then something that's probably way more painful than the realization that you're living with an alcoholic is that your trust has been shattered. That has nothing to do with alcohol. Or maybe it did, you know?
There are overlaps I came to see. But what I was doing in that time frame is questioning everything about, I adore this man. I thought he adored me. Now everything that has ever happened in our marriage, I don't know what was real and what wasn't. I don't know who this man is. I don't know how he feels about me, how he ever felt about me.
And 20 years in. Yeah. 20 years in.
That's right.
Sorry, I cut you off.
It is that crazy, how can this be real?
Yeah.
And the other thing that was happening is I was questioning myself. How do I not know this? How could I not have suspected something?
Do you feel...
What kind of an idiot am I?
Yeah.
Utter fool. Oh. Utter fool to have been in the relationship. Utter fool that I did not know. Utter fool that I was still laying in a ball on the floor rather than grabbing the meanest divorce attorney I could find immediately. But I couldn't act. I was just frozen in pain.
And is that pretty common?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what many people experience infidelity in their marriages.
That I know is common, but I mean
that to have the entire basis for your marriage being shown to be a lie. I don't know what is normal and what is common. I think I'm still grappling with that.
And so then what happened to your marriage?
I did eventually get up off the floor and initiated divorce proceedings. And I still don't have a good way to talk about this or explain it, but we ended up getting back together. What I can only talk about it in pieces, and it sounds ridiculous even to my own ears as I say it, as I lived it. There was still so much love between us. I knew that his sexual behavior had nothing to do with me, just like his drinking had nothing to do with me. There was a psychological hole inside him that he was filling with booze and sex. Sex was not an addiction. The addiction was to his own validation. Eventually, I came to understand that it was, he was a man who didn't believe he deserved love. Didn't believe he could have love. Didn't, even after 20 some years of marriage, he thought I was going to leave. And he ended up basically playing out that behavior. I don't, consciously or unconsciously, always being prepared never to be alone and to have the validation of another warm body always at the ready. And he probably enjoyed the game of hiding it as well. But it wasn't about me at the core. And because we'd gone through so much of the alcoholism, the compartmentalization, I at least, as much as it hurt and how awful it was, mm-hmm. and how personal and painful, underneath intellectually, I understood that even his sexual behavior was not about me. At that point, he was no longer drinking. We had separated. I had filed for divorce. He didn't have to stay in therapy. He didn't have to go into therapy to try to figure out the sexual component. He did anyway. And we eventually made the choice to try what we thought would be the harder path than divorce.
And you weren't doing it for the children because they were in college.
Correct.
At that
they were
point.
Gone. This was just the two of us strangely still loving each other, strangely committed to trying to understand the core of all of this. I still believe this is an amazing guy who happens to have psychological problems that played out in our marriage, that played out and turned me into collateral damage. But that's where we were, and we made an attempt to try to see if there was anything there, anything we could rebuild, replace, start anew. I'm not quite sure, but we did that.
And how did that turn out?
We seemed to be doing okay, but it was a situation where he loved me more and I loved him less. And we said that. We were conscious about it. We are aware of it. I had numerous guardrails in place. And we were doing the hard work. He participated fully in the hard work of trying to show me that he deserved a place in my life after such atrocious behavior. He did everything I could have asked. He became a model husband. He was contrite and generous, and every moment that I lost it on him, he behaved in a way that I would have wanted and expected. He did not give defensive. He was sincerely trying to understand his behavior and trying to keep me in his life. And I was hoping through that process I would find the depth of the love that I had felt for him. But that's when COVID hit. And COVID showed me something about myself that I hadn't seen as fully. And that was the emptiness that was still inside me. The emptiness that all of those years of addiction had drained of me. The emptiness that his sexual behavior and the betrayal and the hurt had drained of me. And here we were, two people, still loving each other to some degree, not like before, trying to figure out if there was a way that time would heal us, that our hard work would heal us, that the ongoing therapy we were both doing would heal us. But COVID showed me that without all the other distractions in my life, of a busy life, mm-hmm. we all get, my emptiness was going to remain. And that's when I really had to make a choice. And that's when the second divorce, the real divorce, happened. Because I could not fathom a life of emptiness. And I'm going to interject one thing that he would say to me after I left. And that was, I would do anything for you. And that's something that we say in love. That's something we believe mm-hmm. to be true at the core of how we define love. But I think, one, it's really not true. There are always limits to what we would do for another person. And what we learned, what I learned anyway, was what those depths were, how far I would go for this love. And I found out that, yes, I love this man, but I will not live empty for him. And what he would not do with me, for me, is he would not reopen my pain. He would not hear me. He would not hear the agony that I was still experiencing, because it would make him have to look at himself again. Mm. He was still compartmentalizing. He was trying hard to make it right, but he could not say, how can I help you? Let me listen, talk to me. He couldn't do that. That was the limit. He didn't want to feel bad anymore. So we found our limits, and we had to go our separate ways.
What, if anything, did you discover once you were, I don't know, at any point during being with him or afterwards, about the parts of yourself that you had ignored, that the obsession about his drinking or whatever it might have been had masked? I.e. the things, if we're in a support group for codependence and they tell us, let's focus on you, what are you feeling? That has nothing to do with them. Mm-hmm. Was there a process of that happening for you?
I think it's one of those both things can be true scenarios. I don't regret, I have not looked back on and regretted that I did everything I could to keep the man I loved alive. I don't regret any of that. But what I didn't do is speak about it to the people that were closest to me. That's what I needed to do better. I needed to find avenues, whether it was speaking more thoroughly and more openly to people I knew I could trust, or a technique that I have come to appreciate, journaling. I wasn't letting the pain out. And it was really only after I started journaling, because I had no avenue for putting a framework to my pain. Therapy is good, but an hour once a week, left me unfulfilled in some ways. So I was using journaling as a way to supplement. And through that process, that's when I could see the whole of, through the part, you know, the forest through the trees. I would have and would advise anybody in a similar situation, don't hold it in. The people that love you want to help you. They are not going to be as judgmental about it as you expect them to. When you eventually tell them, you're going to hear what I heard, which is, I wish I had known. I would have been there for you. But it wasn't my fear of their judgment that I was protecting. It was a fear of myself, because I didn't perhaps want to face the whole. Maybe I wanted to stay in the little bits because they were easier to manage.
Yeah, opening the door.
When you open the door and you really speak broadly and boldly about what's going on, there comes some responsibility to act. And sometimes you're not ready to act. Nor can you, most of us can't, safely go to trusted loved ones over and over and over and over whining. You know, we think about it as whining. If we're not taking action to do something, whether that's stepping out of the relationship, giving the relationship a break, doing your own version of therapy, whatever mm-hmm. it is, there is this perception because it's kind of in your face as a mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less about the people you tell and more about your own perception of how they're going to view you as weak or a victim or how can you not see this? All of those things are going on in our minds. It is the judgment that we fear because we're not ready to face it.
And I also think it's a sense of giving up control. It's out of the box at that point, and we can't lock it
True.
Back in. And I don't know about you, but there are a few things that scare me as much as the unknown.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true of us, most of us. And I think that also is one of the components that keeps a lot of us in broken marriages longer, broken relationships longer than we need to be, because we're so afraid of what we don't know on the other side. We can't make those changes until our fear of staying where we are is worse than the mm-hmm. fear of what might be next for us. We got to be able to picture something on the other side, even if it's something really small. We have to get there because there's a comfort, this not knowing of what is life going to look like for me. I'm a middle-aged woman. What is it, you know, alone for the first time in decades? What does a life look like for me? I don't know. Those are big, legitimate fears because we know what we've experienced. We keep holding on to hope that it's going to get better, that our love will be enough. But in the meantime, we're allowing ourselves to be drained. And that is the saddest part of my experience, and I think a lot of people's experience, the amount of time we lose in that silence, how we let that silence eat away at us. I don't know if there's a better way to put it, but holding on, we hold on.
Mm-hmm.
We're silent for so long. It becomes too big of a thing to even start to speak about. Where do I begin?
Where do I begin? Finding the words for what we're feeling, thinking, afraid of. Sometimes I think that's even a bigger hurdle than saying to someone, I need help.
Yeah.
I'm lonely. I'm scared. Whatever the words may be, it's the anticipation. I don't know about you, but for me, the anticipation that I'm not going to phrase it right. And then I'm going to waste that person's time or my time or whatever.
We'll be judged
yeah.
for how we say it, what we say. That something important to us and deeply emotional will not be respected and heard with the care it needs.
Mm-hmm.
And we're juggling our trust of the individual and our trust of ourselves.
So would you say that there is... or at least was a fear that your needs aren't going to be met if you voice them?
There were a couple of things going on. You know, marital loyalty was a big part to me. Talking openly about my husband's flaws, his weaknesses, his failings, would not have been received well by him. It would not be received well. I guess I didn't view it as something helpful to the state of my marriage.
And that's understandable, but I guess I'm talking more about cultivating a support network.
Yeah, later on, I think, as the reality, I was probably more up against, it's been, you know, you were living like this for 20 years. Where do you begin? How do I start the conversation? And I, you know, have a small group of people that I trust and I would share small bits of my life with. But you don't download 20 years of feelings in a single conversation. And quite frankly, there's so much hindsight. There's so much I was still piecing together that I didn't have a good framework for how I felt about it. I didn't have the distance yet to look back. Yeah, I can say my husband is a lying, cheating drunk, but what does that that doesn't make me feel better. That doesn't really help me heal. Mm. I had to understand what I was feeling about it all. And so for me, that's where I had given some voice through therapy and through a sister and a good friend, bits of my story. But the whole thing, I hadn't told anyone, no one at all. And that's when I was really finding journaling to be immensely helpful. It gave me a framework to understand the perspective of what I really had given up, what I really felt along the way. And I hadn't been able to see that when I was so entrenched in the trauma of the moments.
Mm-hmm. Were there any insights about your life before you met him? Through journaling or therapy or support groups? Talk about those.
In the process of journaling and support groups, one of the things that I was really spending a lot of time thinking back to is my personal childhood upbringing. I was raised to be the good little girl. I'm the oldest of five kids. You know, you are there to be pretty and smart and keep your mouth shut and do what you're told. And this is what we reward you for as a girl that grew up when I did. And there's still so many parts of that that I think are in me or were in me at the beginning stage of the marriage. How we view marital roles, how we view male and female relationships, how we view ourselves as women in a marriage when our spouse is the primary earner. I mean, there are some dynamics that play out, and I had to think about all of those things as I was putting together the framework of why was I silent? Why could I not speak what was going on? And also during the worst stages, I'm grappling with my whole concept of expressing anger because I was not raised to be somebody who raised my voice and threw things and had temper tantrums. Mm-hmm. I sure as hell was entitled to have a few temper tantrums along the way, but I hadn't learned as a girl how to properly express anger. Women were thought of as shrill, and you have to couch your words in ways that we sound tough, but instead we're called names.
When you look back on your life as a child, an adolescent, do you remember tamping down not just anger, but rage? Or were you out of touch with that part of yourself? Or maybe it didn't exist. I don't know how any human being, especially a female raised in the patriarchy that you were raised in, how you could not have rage, whether you were in touch with it or not.
I don't think as a girl I was in touch with rage. Anger, was it tamped down? Absolutely. Parents who, you don't raise your voice, don't yell at me, you don't get to talk back. Those things are just common, were common in my upbringing.
Did you have male siblings?
I'm the oldest of five. So the boys were, substantially younger. And
what were the differences that you noticed in how your parents, the rules for them, or how they were talked to versus how you were talked to? Were there differences that kind of came onto your radar, or was it pretty much the same across the board?
I don't remember distinct moments in childhood, and I think that probably has to do with the age difference, me just not being cognizant of how we were spoken to or how we were expected to deal with normal childhood anger.
Gotcha.
I don't really have a sense of that. And then I left, as soon as I could get to college, I was out of the house and didn't really see how they were regarded as teenagers with rage issues of their own.
Yeah. What, if anything, did you discover that you needed to own about yourself? I guess what I'm trying to get to, when we've been wronged, it's very easy to just focus on where we've been wronged and not look at our part in things. And I'm not accusing you of that. I'm just asking if a part of your process were anything's dawning on you that, like, wow, I do this and that's not okay. Were there any light bulb moments for you or gradual moments of enlightenment about where you needed to own your shit?
The biggest light bulb in all of this in that area is silence. I was silent too much of my life. Silent about things that hurt me, silent about my needs, silent about how I was spoken to, silent about other people's behavior. That whole just suck it up and be silent, because this is not how females are supposed to behave. So what I have to own, and that's a big part of writing this book in the first place, is I have to own my voice. I have to find my voice. I have to find the way forward to share these very personal things that we are discussing that 5 years ago I could not have shared. It is my voice, the lack of my voice, the lack of using my voice, the lack of feeling entitled to have opinions about how I was treated, to ask for behaviors and changes. That is my biggest failing in life. And that's for me to own.
What had been the scariest things for you to voice, whether it was publicly in your writing or seeing it written as you journaled?
The most difficult part of all of this is the grappling that I've had to do with the knowledge that my husband had led a secret sex life throughout our marriage, and I didn't divorce him as soon as I knew.
And what were the thoughts towards yourself about that?
What the hell is wrong with me? There is obviously, who stays with a man who treats her this way?
What were the names that you would call yourself, if there were any? Assigning qualities or characters to yourself.
It felt like I was allowing myself accepting a role as victim, accepting a role as not having equal power in my life, not having an equal right to my emotions, to my sense of self, that I was not taking responsibility for my sense of self.
Was there ever a I don't know what the words would be to describe it, but was there ever a dawning on you that I'm repeating the cycle of what I endured as a child, but I am now steering the ship and doing it to myself? The silence, I mean, not the being cheated on.
Yeah, the silence was just something that I became hyper aware of as a complete theme in my life. And I grappled with that as I grappled with the decision to be really public. Obviously, I'm being very public in writing a book and having conversations with people like you. And I knew that the writing was in part therapy. And it's very therapeutic to write this stuff down and get it out. But it's a whole nother thing to release it into the world. So I had to grapple with, do I have the courage to not just write this, but to say it, to own that this is what I experienced. Here are the choices that I made. Some of the choices I don't like a lot. Some of the choices I can't comfortably defend. But I'm going to talk about them anyway. And if people judge me for that, they judge me for that. Because if I didn't go forward with publishing the book, then I knew it was a silence that I was choosing. I was allowing fear consciously to hold me back from something that I felt was very, very important to not only me personally, but for anybody else who might have been in this place of silence. If I can find my voice, I can help other people. But if I don't go forward and get this book into the world, I'm staying quiet and small and silent. And I can't live with myself if I do that.
What are the biggest fears in putting it out there into the world? You know, maybe the negative fantasies that your brain tells you might happen.
Sure. Fear of women that he was involved with coming out of the woodwork. That's being approached. There is fear of the judgment still of how could you have stayed with this man once you knew the truth?
By women, by men, anybody?
I think by women, largely. Because it's just, I can't fully grapple with the weakness component. How weak I felt, how much I grappled with that. Is this strong to try to work this out? Or is this the weakest thing a woman could do?
Boy, what a shitty place to be in. That line between self-advocacy and compassion.
Yes. Yes. And that is, and there's really a theme there, as you say it that way. That is part of the theme of living with an addict. That line between compassion for the person you love and compassion for yourself. Advocating for yourself. Advocating for the person who is the addict. And it continues through your recovery and your healing, and now it's here for me in a different way.
And I think it's really probably one of the biggest challenges in life, along with, I don't know about you, but trying to find a balance between work and play. Mm. Those are the two most difficult lines to manage, and I suppose there's no perfect way of doing it, but boy, it can be confusing. You know, I had an epiphany in one of my support groups one night where I realized, and it was really around my relationship with my mom and having to cut contact with her, was realizing that it's important to have compassion for others, but not at the expense of compassion for ourselves. And if we don't get in touch with our feelings, we don't even know where to begin to understand where compassion for ourselves, where self-advocacy begins, and what we are entitled to. What are the boilerplate needs in any interpersonal relationship that are non-negotiable? Being talked to with respect, you know, feeling respected, feeling listened to, and not that other person needs to be perfect, but do they apologize? Do they seem genuine in their apology? And are their actions matching their words? Those were the things that I had to finally look at. Do any of those ring true for you?
Yeah, I understand those completely. I think the fear that I had in myself and the fear that I have for others who've been in these situations is that continued silence prevents you from ever facing that compassion. Mm-hmm. You can't do it. You stay in pain and you stay stuck. I think the hardest thing that any of us ever do is to look at ourselves in the mirror, because it's really easy to rationalize, to blame, to avoid. And there's no healing. There's no good self-worth. If we can't look at ourselves and say, I did this. I'm not proud of it. I'm good at this. I'm not good at that. These are the things I admire about myself. These are the things I need to change. And a lot of us spend a lot of time avoiding looking at ourselves in the mirror. particularly where this overlaps with addictive behaviors, whether it's an addict looking at themselves or we as loved ones looking at ourselves or looking at the addict.
Amen. A fucking men. Anything else you'd like to share before we wrap up?
I would just hope sincerely that anybody that is struggling with addiction in their lives, in their relationships, anywhere, that you find some way to slowly end your silence. I have suggested to people who found journaling too frightening, write it down and throw it in the shredder if you must.
Yes.
Get the pain out of your heart and out of your head. Find ways. Find someone you can speak to. And it doesn't have to be all at once. You cannot heal. You can't get better. You will only stay broken if you do not find ways to end your silence.
Thank you so much for coming on. Your book is called Where the Shadows Dance. He got sober, I got broken.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
And where can people, are you on social media? Where can people find out more about you?
My website is danakillian.com. I'm at Dana Killian Author on Instagram and Facebook.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Many thanks to Dana. And maybe my jokes were objectively unfunny. Or maybe she's doing that thing that I do sometimes where I miss a joke that somebody, I'm so focused on not losing my train of thought that I don't pick up that somebody made a joke. I bet that's what was happening. Because otherwise, I got to go, Paul, your jokes are fucking lame. And I can't go there right now. We're going to take a quick break, see if we have any sponsors. This is from the Ask Paul Anything survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls himself Out of Bounds. And he writes, I've always struggled with defining a purpose for my life, which I think has contributed to my lifelong depressions. Did starting the podcast help with providing a meaning to your life and alleviating some of the depression symptoms? Great question. Thank you for that. And I would say there's two types for me of depressions that can kind of eat away at me. One is the, I don't know, what would you call it? Physical, biological depression. And the other is situational depression. And this, it definitely helped with the situational depression because to me, one of the best tools is a feeling for the situational is a shift in perspective, which for me is helped by community, human connection, vulnerability, trying to be of service, et cetera, et cetera. That is not, however, going to erase the biological depression that I deal with. And for that, I find it necessary to take meds, which I'm not crazy about, but it is what it is. So I don't know if that answered your question. I hope it did. This is from the comment on someone's survey, and this is filled out by Beer There Done That. And she writes, episode number 689. This is in response to the survey by Dim and Tonic at 135.58. In this survey, Dim and Tonic expresses that his wife experiences postpartum depression, weight gain, and heroic snoring. For those of you that don't know, heroic snoring is snoring that's like so loud you could hear it, you know, on the other side of walls. Now they are sleeping in separate bedrooms and he is touch starved. I want to say, I am someone similar to your wife. I experienced weight gain and postpartum. Luckily, I did not begin snoring. What I wanted to respond to is that my depression was hard and it drained every ounce of sexual desire from my body, mind, and soul. It affected my relationship. I want to say that it can get better. I was very lucky to receive the support of my husband. It took a long time, but it did strain the relationship. I finally started doing Zoom meetings with a therapist that specializes in sex. I've been on antidepressants, which helped the suicidal ideation go away, but never increased my sex drive. I want to just give a couple of suggestions I got from my sex therapist. Watch the show The Principles of Pleasure Together on Netflix. by your wife, the book Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski, and the little workbook that comes along with it. Maybe consider reading it yourself to help understand how women experience or not arousal. These things helped me, and I hope they help you. If they don't, just please know not to internalize. I guarantee she loves you or loved you, but our brains are sometimes the meanest little assholes. It can get better. Thank you so much for that. I love when you guys respond warmly to each other. It's, I don't know, just makes me feel so good. This is from the Struggle in a Sentence survey filled out by a guy who calls himself Sweaty Boy, and about his anxiety. Don't ask me to plan for the future. Just punch me in the stomach and get it over with. Snapshot from his life. About 6 years ago, I was having a fun afternoon with my friends at the ocean baths, swimming and laughing with safe, beautiful people. As soon as I put my head underwater, I was hit with a sickening sense of dread. I have an intense and overwhelming fear of death. So once the happy distractions above the surface were muffled, I was alone with my own thoughts underwater. I felt like this beautiful afternoon was pointless, because one day I'll die, and then everyone will be gone. Wow. Wow. Just from putting your head underwater. That's amazing. I do not recommend that you get waterboarded. I don't think that that would be as pleasurable of an experience as you think it would be. This is an awfulsome moment filled out by Dot. And she writes, I work for a law firm and I also do online sex cam modeling. Sometimes I turn on the cam site at my desk and do private shows in the bathroom at my office. One day I was in the stall with all of my clothes off and a guy was on my phone screen jerking off when my coworker walked in. I forgot to lock the fucking stall. It was a long day at work for me. My God, that is. And the fact that you were totally nude. That. And that is probably the kindness, most compassionate, most altruistic thing that happened in a law firm on earth that day. Did I just throw all the lawyers, all the good lawyers under the bus? I did. This is from the Shame and Secrets survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Elsie. She identifies as straight. She's in her 30s, says that she was raised in a slightly dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Yes, and I reported it. I was molested as a child by a close relative, and it obviously shaped and warped my view on safety and boundaries, not in a good way. Duh, man, I suck. But the worst of all was 17-year-old me finally breaking down and telling my mom what happened and feeling like a 1,000-pound elephant was lifted off my shoulder and going to sleep and going to sleep having the best night's sleep in forever, because teenage me thought, there, everything will be better now. Cue the audience laughter. The fallout of certain family members not believing me and others who do, and then realizing everyone is talking about it and you thinking, hold the fuck up. What about him? Ugh, no wonder why people take shit to the grave. She's also been emotionally abused. She writes, when it's family and someone you love so much, it messes with your mind on another level. I used to be ashamed to admit the emotional abuse I experienced from a close female relative, that was worse than the sexual abuse from a male relative. But after doing some work and realizing all abuse is abuse, and I'm allowed to feel however the fuck I feel about it, I'm coming to terms with my feelings. Darkest thoughts. I have pure OCD, so I have a million dark thoughts a day that are terrifying. So I think if I had a true dark thought, I wouldn't even recognize it. Darkest secrets. I used to be a liar. I lied about everything. It started when I was in middle school and I felt so broken from sexual abuse and from emotional abuse that I hated myself, hated everything. And so I would make up lies to make myself seem better. And it spiraled out of control. I would never believe my lies. I would feel sick about them and wish I could take it back. I'd feel them coming out and then thinking, why the fuck did you say that? But then I would get some sort of attention that wasn't telling me I was less than or wasn't good enough, which is what regular me would get, and I would almost get a high off of it. It continued until I was in my 20s, and I wanted to stop as it gave me crippling anxiety that I would get caught as a liar and nothing would embarrass me more. But I was deep in a relationship that I was too codependently wrapped up in, so I was trapped in a body of lies. Once that relationship was over, I made the decision to not lie anymore. Cold turkey, like drugs and alcohol. And while I still did some white lies, because sometimes life calls for it, I stopped lying. And I was just boring, plain, regular me. And the hardest part for me was after I stopped trying to be something I'm not, I met the best of friends that 15 years later I'm still best friends with. I met my husband, who is better than I deserve, and life was annoyingly good and fun. The reason why it's so hard, I could have had that all along if I had just learned to love myself, parentheses, which I don't. I still have that inner mean girl who's a cunt, but I'm trying. And it's hard because I can talk about being clean and sober off drugs and booze and people congratulate me and can relate. But if I say, hey, I used to be a liar, people always look at you like, so how do I know you're not lying still now? So I feel like it's my darkest secret forever because I'm always too scared no one will understand or believe me, which then still makes me a liar. Vicious circle I got myself in, eh? I don't think that's you lying by not sharing that with somebody. I think we just need to choose who we're going to share it with, whether it's a therapist or a trusted friend. The important thing is that you're not using that bad coping mechanism anymore and that you're fucking sober. And kind of like what I was saying in the survey, I think it was before the interview, just when somebody congratulates you, thank them. Take it in. They don't need to know you used to be a liar. And by the way, I think you would make an awesome guest. If you ever find yourself in Southern California, I would love to talk about compulsive lying. And no, I'm not lying. I would actually. It's such an obvious joke. I would love to talk to you about that. This is from the Shame and Secret Survey, and this is filled out by a guy who calls himself Dusty. He identifies as straight. He's in his 40s, says that he was raised in a pretty dysfunctional environment. Ever been the victim of sexual abuse? Yes, and I never reported it. When 10 years old, I moved into a new neighborhood and was trying desperately to make friends. Most of the kids were much older, and one day, several of them forced me to get naked along with an 8-year-old girl. We were forced to touch and fondle each other in front of the group. I was told to crawl on top of her and have sex with her. After the incident, I avoided these kids at all cost, as well as the girl. I isolated myself inside my house and never played outside again. Not knowing much about sex for the next year, I feared she might be pregnant. For many years, I felt like I was the perpetrator in the event as I had done things to this younger girl, but just in the last few years realized I was just as much a victim. I've spent the majority of my life feeling guilt over this, and it has destroyed my relationships with women. When a relationship begins, the women love how attentive I am to their needs, but I'm doing these things out of guilt as I see a part of that young girl in every woman I date. I let all my needs go, and in time, I begin to get resentful that my needs are not are not me. My needs are not, I think he meant to type, are not met. I turn to things like drugs and pornography to cope. This, of course, causes more problems as I hide and lie to them about what's going on. I feel so much shame. I self-sabotage things, for I do not feel like I deserve anything good in my life, even though I want nothing more than to grow old with someone by my side that loves me just as much as I love them. He shares that he's never been physically abused, but has been emotionally abused. I had a girlfriend who was emotionally abusive, treated me poorly, and in front of me would flirt with my friends and make sexual comments to them just to make me feel bad. My wife of 18 years was a drug addict and would disappear for days at a time. At times, she would hold herself hostage and refuse to come home unless I gave her money for drugs. I loved her very much, for when she was sober, she was the greatest person I had ever known. But when she would be gone, it destroyed me inside. I would tell myself, if my wife doesn't want to be around me, how could anybody want to be around me? I would lay awake at night, worrying about what she was doing and who she was with. Fear and anxiety rules my world. Any positive experiences with abusers? My wife and I had many wonderful moments and have a son together who means the world to me. She's been clean for 5 years now, but resentment is still a big problem. Darkest thoughts. I still think about what happened that day to me and that little girl. I'm not a pedophile and not attracted to children, but is disgusting as I feel about it. I get aroused, but it also makes me feel sick. And that is not unusual. The brain does a weird thing of taking trauma and sexualizing it. And it's not a moral, I don't know what you... has nothing to do with morality or lack of morality. It's just your brain coping with trauma. Darkest secrets. I'm a people pleaser and just want others to like me. I'm not attracted to men, but I once agreed to give a guy a hand job and was turned on by it. As we got into the act, I gave him oral sex and I enjoyed it. I don't find men attractive, but am turned on thinking back on pleasing him. Sexual fantasy is most powerful to you. Threesomes are a sexual fantasy of mine. The thought of sharing my wife horrifies me, but the thought of sharing a woman with another man is arousing. I want to be with her at the same time as him, as well as after she has been with him. Maybe she is with him somewhere and comes home to me to be with me afterwards. She got what she needed from him, but she finishes the night with me. Sharing this makes me feel like it gives me power over this instead of shame about it. I'm glad you feel that way. What, if anything, would you like to say to someone you haven't been able to? I would like to say to that little girl that I'm sorry we had to go through that. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish for a truly honest and meaningful relationship. Have you shared these things with others? I've shared this with others, and I always feel like I'm burdening them with my feelings. I say it all the time, but it is about finding the right tribe, and the right tribe will be grateful for you sharing your feelings, and they will not feel burdened. They will feel closer to you, and they will feel more comfortable sharing their stuff with you. My support group last night, there were two people that were new, and they opened up, and they were so shocked at the outpouring of love and connection during and after that meeting. And it was so beautiful to see, because when they first came in, you know, they're kind of, their heads were down and their shoulders were slumped. And afterwards, their eyes were bright and clear. And you could just see that there was a glimmer of hope in them. And that, I can't even put it into words. I never get tired of it. What, if anything, do you wish for? I wish for a truly honest and meaningful relationship. We already read these. How do you feel after writing these things down? I feel lots of anxiety, but I know the more I talk about it, the better and easier it will get. Thank you, man. What a beautiful survey. And, you know, obviously not the stuff that you and that little girl had to go through, but the fact that you have perspective on it now and some of the shame's being released. And finally, this is a happy moment. And by the way, if you want to hear more surveys at the $5 and above Patreon level, there's every week, starting about 3 months ago, 2 months ago, we do weekly bonus surveys for Patreon donors at the $5 and above level. And it's about, averages about 15 minutes of surveys a week. This is from the Happy Moments survey, and this is filled out by a woman who calls herself Dot, and she writes, I've always battled low self-esteem and depression. The voice in my head was constantly berating me and calling me names until I read A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle. I realized I could just observe that voice in my head and not become entangled with the drama. I create my own drama and then believe it. So profound to be able to step outside that stream of thought. By the way, it's one of the most profound and helpful books I've ever read. I was driving to a doctor appointment when I looked at myself in the rear view mirror and said, I love you, Dorothy. You are beautiful. And I truly fucking believed it for the first time ever. I feel so much peace and compassion now. I understand that my emotional nature is a gift that I must learn to harness for correct use. I am not weak or a loser. I am sensitive, and this harsh world needs more of that shit. Love you, Dorothy. Music?
To my ears.
Love it. Love it! You out there? Your tribe's out there, man. Your tribe's out there. It's so scary, that first step. Going to a support group or going to therapy or opening up to somebody. But it's so worth it. It's so worth it. It absolutely turned my life around. I shudder to think where I would be without it. So if you're out there and you're feeling stuck, just never forget that you are not alone. And thanks for listening.
Everybody I know is bizarrely beautiful.
Everybody I know is
bizarrely beautifully
fucked up in some weird way.
Bizarrely beautifully fucked up in some weird way.